Welcome back to Remember What's Next, the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro, an author, educator, and world-renowned Israeli tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we began by exploring Jewish unity, but quickly pivoted to address the world and Jewish experiences in history post-October 7th. We are having conversations and updates on what is happening on the ground in Israel, as well as what is happening to Jews in the diaspora, and turning to our history to try to understand how to navigate what is happening moment to moment and to predict or see what is coming down the pipeline. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people. Welcome to Remember What's Next.
One. Okay, welcome back, everyone. Ken, nice to be back with you.
Always, even in these intense times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we are pre-Passover, literally, you know, like a few days down the road. That's about to begin for us. We just on Saturday, this past Saturday, saw an absolutely stunning turn of events where we watched Iran shoot over 350 drones, missiles, all sorts of, you know, projectiles directly at Israel. This is, you know, again, we are in unprecedented territory. I think people are feeling very, if they weren't disconcerted already, which really we have been, now they're really also saying, hey, wait a second, this is, again, something we've never seen before, not even sure how to deal with this. Is Israel alone? I will mention, actually, that I heard at a fundraiser on Sunday morning, I heard Dan Senner and Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik speak live, which was a fascinating kind of commentary on what they feel is happening and how we can relate to this. But today, I think we're going to, and I'm happy to throw anything that I can remember properly as best I can into the conversation. But I think where we wanted to start with was, what are we looking at in terms of the historical context? I think you mentioned as we were preparing for this show, like, hey, we've seen this before. So what are we looking at? When have we seen this before? And how can that help us contextualize and perhaps regulate ourselves a little bit so that we can make some good decisions? And I think just as an aside, that's one of the things that we're really seeing play out in Israel, which is the same as they did before they went into Gaza. They took this long breath. You know, we talk about Hashem being Erech HaPayim, right? Takes a long-nosed breath before they actually went into Gaza. I think we're maybe seeing a little bit of that again in terms of deciding how they're going to respond to Iran, in terms of what they're going to do next. So how do we all take a nice long breath and choose, you know, our response and how we're going to deal with this? And how does that contextualize also with Passover? So where should we begin?
Yeah, so I mean, taking a long and on the kind of front page news geopolitical realities, you know, just as October 7th was like a big inflection point in the world and especially for Israel, what happened on Saturday night was pretty unbelievable. I mean, I didn't. First of all, it was so surreal, just from my perspective, being in Israel and being in Jerusalem. Like I turn on the news and Iran was all floating around the news for days that Iran's going to do something because Israel took out, you know, an Iranian general in Syria in the compound. It wasn't the embassy building, but it was near. And it was as if they violated Syrian, you know, because embassies are considered an extension of a country's territory, even if it's not in the territory. Iran was threatening to respond and everyone knew it was coming. And then, you know, on Saturday night, the great thing about Shabbat is, you know, you turn it all off and you don't think about it. And that's, but then the first thing you do, especially when you're in Israel, when things are intense, is you listen to the news. What happened? What did I miss? And you look on your phone. And literally, and Shabbat goes out, they announce. And this was the weirdest thing. I've been here through, you know, 42 years. I've been through Scud missile attacks in 1990 and, you know, gotten used to it. But this was like Iran has just launched hundreds of drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, And because, well, actually, the cruise and the ballistic missiles came later because they travel at faster speeds. But literally, they're telling us what time they're going to arrive.
Wow.
Like, okay, everyone's
Wow.
sitting there waiting. And I just remember saying, I'm not going to sleep. They said about between like 1:30 and 2:30. And this, I'm like, no way I'm going to sleep. First of all, I don't be woken up by a siren. It's very
Right.
disturbing. And
I mean,
I'm just
being
watching
in
the
North
news. Yeah.
America, this is absolutely otherworldly. Like, if somebody was on the news saying, in 2.5 hours, there are 350 missiles about to be like about to arrive in Toronto. Like the
Right.
panic and absolute freak out on people's behalves. Like, we don't think about it in North America. We're like, oh yeah, of course there's missiles being launched at Israel because that happens every day, which in itself is crazy. But like, I cannot imagine just sitting waiting to see what's going to happen, like what's going to hit, what's not going to hit. It's mind-boggling how different that state of mind is, and really goes to this idea that if you live in North America, you have no clue what's going on in the Middle East unless you live there.
Right. No, absolutely. And then, of course, a few hours later, they announced that then they've launched the ballistic missiles because they have traveled faster. So they wait to shoot them. Happens to be just an interesting story. I was on Friday guiding a photographer. There's a certain political pundit personality from Fox News who was in Israel. And I was doing a show with him. And I took his photographer out on Friday and took him on a 4-hour tour to kind of pre-shoot a lot of the sites. And he's a guy who's he's Jewish, but he hadn't been in Israel since 1980, when he was 9 years old. And the guy is literally freaking out. He's staying in a building. He's an Airbnb in a building that I can see from my window right here, right off right of the side over here. He's like
Wow.
literally 300 yards away from me. And I immediately said, I gotta calm this guy down because I know what it's like for people who haven't been through this before. We're
For
very
sure.
like kind of complacent about it because of thank God, because of the Iron Dome and everything. But he was literally freaking out. His wife was in America freaking out even more. So he said, "What do I do?" I said, "Go down, ask for this. If the sirens go off, go to the room. We all know the drill. You go to the room, you wait like 10, 15 minutes, and go down to the concierge in the building and ask where the safe space is and whatever." I was talking literally, I was coaching him through the entire process until
Wow.
3 in the morning until he finally collapsed from exhaustion. He said, "Should I stay in the lobby all night?" I said, "No, I think it's over." And I go to sleep and I wake up.
Wow.
But so it was very it's like we've gotten so used to it. Things that freak other people out are really quite normal here. That's being the Jewish people in general. Our history is not normal, and certainly being in Israel, it's not normal. But it really was on a geopolitical level before we like pull back and look at the deeper historical context and where it fits into our worldview. It was a big game changer in terms of the Middle East, in terms of this is Iran's first direct. It was an open act of war. Iran's been declared war on Israel for years. I mean,
Right.
the fact that they're allowed to exist in the United Nations when they openly call for the destruction of another member state of the UN, which is, by the way, a violation of the UN Charter. The whole UN's all
Yep.
about peace. And here's a, we haven't done anything to them. We don't have a border with them. They just have been calling. They call us a cancer and we have to be eliminated. And then they actually tried to do it. But the every what's floating around in Israel, we've talked about this before when dealing with Islam and the Islamic worldview. And Iranians are not Arabs, but they are Muslims. And the Middle East is the Middle East. There's certain attitudes and assumptions about how things work here, and Israel realizes this is even though the whole formula is really weird because we intercepted 99% of the missiles with the help of America and England, and even the Jordanians shot a few down, and the French were involved. I don't know who was doing what, but this kind of this weird notion that because their attack wasn't successful, we shouldn't do anything about it.
Right.
Biden was basically telling Israel, take the hit, take the hit. You didn't lose anyone except like a Bedouin girl, unfortunately, who was very badly wounded, and a few missiles hit an Air Force base but didn't do any damage. But that's an insane idea. Trust
Well,
me, if
I mean,
Mexico
also,
wants
if you look at
300,
American law, you have a charge called attempted murder, and you can go to jail for it. Like, it just because your murder doesn't succeed doesn't mean you didn't try to kill someone. So it's absolutely ludicrous that they would say, well, because you're fine, we're not going to do anything about it.
and it's also another great example of what we've talked about many times, the crazy double standard Israel held to. Behaving better in warfare and more with more mercy and sending in food food and fuel and water to our enemies and warning them what buildings are. No one does this. America, believe me, if Mexico decided to declare war on America and launch like 300 cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and you know, and suicide drones, you know, within 48 hours there wouldn't be much left of Mexico. No one would be telling America just take the hit. But it really has changed things, and I can tell you here, there's a lot of everyone realizes, in keeping with how things work in the Middle East and the importance of projecting power. Yes, on one hand, it definitely shows Israel's defensive capability, bar none. There's no one has the missile defense system that Israel has, a multi-tiered system that can take out everything from, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles to you know, little short-range rockets. But it's about who gets the last slap. And Iran immediately, because it recognizes how the game works and recognizes that especially the U.S. government does not want this to escalate, even if it really needs to escalate in a certain level. They know that America's going to put the brakes on Israel like it did with Rafiah and Rafah and what's going on. So they immediately announced, okay, we're even. Okay, don't let's call it even. Just as in peace negotiations, when the negotiations end, you know, you're not going to get to the end of negotiation, but the ball has to be in the other guy's court. So they're the ones saying no. For Israel, and we talked about this literally in the previous podcast, for Israel to end up being slapped in the face, even though it blocked the slap and not slap back, is highly problematic. But the question is, what moves can Israel make that will give Iran the message? And Israel could end Iran immediately. I mean, Iran does not have anything except missiles. The Air Force is a joke.
Right.
Israel could blow up their dams, take out their power. Israel doesn't want to strike the Iranian people. Right. Take out their oil, which is the only source of income they have. Bomb their nuclear program. Israel could reduce Iran into a non-functioning country in a matter of hours if it wanted to. But right. That would mean Iran would respond massively with whatever weapons it has. And Israel doesn't want that to happen. It's already.
And I don't think anybody wants a regional war.
So really, whatever.
And I suspect that's why these other countries got involved. I mean, even though Jordan hilariously is pretending that the projectiles that were being flown over their territory were UFOs of some kind, because they don't want to admit to their own people that they actually got involved in shooting these things down. We still know that Jordan and Saudi Arabia and various other actors were heavily involved in making sure that this attack actually didn't succeed. I'm not sure you could get a better, kind of timing to do something where suddenly you have these allies that have actively stepped up and fought for you in the middle of a war. So it's a really interesting challenge. Nobody, on the other hand, wants to see a regional war. Nobody wants to see Israel have to take on another enemy. Nobody wants to see the destruction that will happen with a regional war of any kind. So it really is, on one hand, no one wants them to go to war and to respond and to just like, okay, let's just leave it. Let's not even get into that. We're still not finished with Gaza and Rafah and getting our hostages back. But on the other hand, as you said, I don't think we totally always understand that to leave that action unanswered puts us at incredible risk.
Exactly. And you point out something very interesting, the kind of the schizophrenic reaction of these Arab countries that have to pay lip service to the Arab world in general and not seem to be siding with Israel, but they're really like, yeah, take Iran out. It's what's really going on versus the kind of the veneer of what's being projected, like UFOs. Give me a break. I mean, the whole thing is very crazy, and the whole thing is very sad because Iran could have been with enough U.S. pressure, if the U.S. hadn't given in previous administrations and taken the pressure off and given them a lot of money. You know, the economic pressure that you put on Iran, the isolation, could really crush that country and make it collapse. And it's been on the verge of collapse. And the reality is the world is leaving Israel to deal with what is a very messy problem, because Iran is the number one supporter, purveyor, provider, financer of terrorism. And the day that Iran goes back to being a normal country, which it has the potential to being, because the Iranian people are actually quite normal and nice and have nothing against Israel, will be one of the greatest days in the history. It'll be like the Cold War ending. It literally will be the end of it'll be the end of radical Islam will take a huge hit. We'll be left with like ISIS, and that'll be kind of it. So, but I don't want to spend the whole time talking about this, but you know, everyone's kind of in. I should tell you what's going on in Israel is
Okay.
Israel keeps announcing we're going to do something. The question is what and when. Will it be on Iranian territory? Because Iran said next time it happens, they're going to respond within seconds. We're going to send 1,000 missiles. So whether they're just bluffing or they're just trying to talk it up to get America to put pressure on Israel, you never know. It's like a poker game here. You know, there's the cards you really have and the image you're trying to project. So it's very tense, very, very tense what's going on. People here are getting back to normal. We're like, okay, that was over with Israel. That we rock out. We had 15 minutes of incredibly intense Friday, Saturday night with I video. I put it. I posted on Instagram. All these missiles like intercepted outside, literally above my building. You know, you can see missiles crashing and you see missiles above the Gold Dome. If they had hit that
Wow.
baby, that would have been quite an interesting thing. Imagine a ballistic missile like hitting the Dome of the Rock. Would have
Right.
blamed Israel.
Right.
But everyone's just kind of waiting to see, and everyone's speculating maybe we should finish with Rafah first and then we could focus on Hezbollah and that finish round. Anyway, we don't know. We don't know. We're in the middle of it, so we
Right.
can't tell. But we haven't. All I want to say is we haven't seen the end of this. Something is going to happen. What, when, we don't know. So, and if, you know, a couple after Passover, well, who knows? It might not be right after Passover, but if, I think in the not too
So,
distant future. Yeah,
right. So for those who,
we'll have a better idea.
for those who can't like see the screen, Ken has this great graphic going on behind his head. So maybe for those who can't see it, if you could just describe it, and for those who can see it, just tell us what this is, and then how do we understand this in terms of what's happening today, and then how does that take us to understand a little bit more about Passover?
Right. So Passover is like the holiday of redemption, freedom from slavery. We're coming into it. Next week we'll be on Passover. There's no accidents. Everything happens for, you know, a reason in this world. And the timing is quite interesting. And I did an interview, I did a podcast with someone a few days ago. It was his show. And he was asking me about how it's going to impact Passover and how, you know, because Passover, by the way, Ellie, is the most kept Jewish ritual that there is in terms of things that Jews do. A lot of Jews don't keep Shabbat. A lot of them make a Passover. In Israel, it's like 87% of Israelis make a Passover a Seder. It's like the
Amazing.
done thing. It's such a part, it's so ingrained deeply in our psyche. So, there's a lot of themes in Passover. One of them is about freedom and redemption. And there's also in the middle of the Passover Seder, because really Passover is in many ways, it's the micro version. The story of slavery to redemption is a mini version of all of Jewish history. It really has a lot of themes in there that will play themselves out for thousands of years to come. And the Passover Seder we're going to have this year, I think, is the 3,337th Passover. Just think about it. That's an amazing thought. That for 3,337 years, Jews have been making Passover Seders.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And in the middle of the Passover Seder, we have these cups and they symbolize different languages of redemption that God took us out of Egypt, different words used. And we even hold up the cup, you know, when we say, it's really wild, like, you know, Jutlachayim, you know, you're holding up the cup. And we say, you know, in every generation, V'hisha'amda, you know, in every generation, Amdu'olei l'chalotenu, that the nations of the world have stood up against us to try and destroy us. They tried to do it in Egypt, you know, 3,330 something years ago. And we say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu min Yadam, but God always saves us from their hand. So that's the beauty of knowing Jewish history is to recognize that we've been there and done that, and that our history is supernatural. And what should give people, I mean, not saying to be complacent, but what normal nations would freak out about, just like missiles landing would freak most people out. And we're like, yeah, we've done that.
Yeah.
We've been there before. This is far from the first people who have tried to destroy us. And the what's in the back of my head, if you could see, is a T-shirt that I made. Actually, made it in 2007. I was thinking about it for probably 7 years before, and I finally got around to making it. And it's just the only piece of it you could see here, but the top of it says civilizations, nations, and empires that have tried to destroy the Jewish people and their status today. And then this is not the entire list, by the way. This is very far from the entire list. It's a fraction of it. But it starts with the big, most of them are our nemesis in the land of Israel and later in the diaspora. But it goes through Philistines, you know, Syrian, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman, Byzantine empires. What's their status today? Gone, 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 gone. Crusaders gone. Spanish Empire gone. Nazi Germany gone. Soviet Union gone. And then at the bottom, there it is. You can see Iran. And on this side, it's got got three question marks.
Yeah, that's so wild. It's
funny because during the Gaza War, several Gaza wars, been a lot of Gaza wars, but I remember in 2014, someone sent me an image for online. Someone took this picture of my shirt, took out Iran, photoshopped in Hamas, and put it in progress. But look, it's ironic. I wasn't thinking about this at the time, but we're back in with Iran now. Iran is at the bottom of the shirt. It's no accident. This is the greatest enemy of the Jewish people today is the you know, Iran and the Islamic Republic of Iran. The fundamentalist Islamic regime are the ones who are openly one of the few countries, you know, that is like a major player. It's openly calling for the destruction of the Jewish state. There's not too many Arab states that are doing that anymore. This is the one country that is feeding that. And then at the bottom of the shirt, by the way, it says, you can't see it, it's cut out of the image. It says, the Jewish people, the smallest of nations, but with a friend in the highest of places. So be nice. And that's what we say when we say Vahishamda. You know, in every generation, they try and destroy us, but God saves us from their hand. And they end badly, by the way. This should be a big lesson. There's a great quote from Thomas Newton, the Bishop of Bristol, from the 18th century. I don't remember the exact quote, but he basically says that all the nations that have come against the Jewish people have come to naught. Now they're gone. And if this is what happened to them, I'm paraphrasing, this should be a lesson to anyone who seeks to raise a hand against them in the future. So that doesn't mean that we're supposed to rely on miracles. Judaism is a very basic statement. In somchin al nes, you don't rely on miracles. You're supposed to make maximum effort. I always say God is a great coach. He's not a good coach doesn't say I want 100% results. I do want 100% effort, a good coach says. So God's saying, you know, you make the efforts, but you recognize I run the world. That is a standard Jewish formula for us to act on a personal level in our lives.
Right.
And yep. For the Jewish nation to act collectively, whether it's in diaspora, the land of Israel, you know, we have to make maximum effort individually and collectively, and God will take care of the rest. And history shows us, you know, that this pattern has repeated itself over and over again. That's extremely comforting for us, especially in difficult times. So that is, I think, you know, we come to this year's Passover Seder. I don't know what the energy is going to be in Toronto and New York, although I think this is going to be an intense Passover Seder for all of us because just a lot has happened.
Yeah.
But in Israel,
and just the energy of subduedness, you know, I don't think it's going to be at least it doesn't feel that it should be the feast and the, you know, the 8-course meal and, you know, just like craziness at the table. Like there does need to be a recognition that we are in the midst of a tenuous and unprecedented situation where everything that we're going to talk about at the Seder table this year is absolutely relevant to what's going on now. You can't say, let my people go and not have it break your heart right now.
Exactly. And you're right. And the essence of the Passover Seder, by the way, is not the meal. You're supposed to have a festive meal because you're celebrating our redemption. But the essence of the Passover meal is telling of the story. Because we Jews are unique in that, you know, because we brought in the idea of one God who acts in history into the world, you know, we kind of shook up the world, the ancient idea that there's no idea of a plot in history, that God's, you know, we brought in the idea of a God who acts in history and that there's no randomness, there's no accident, there's no chance. That history is a control process leading to a destination. We're in a story. There's a producer, there's a director, you want to use a more computer game pro. There's a gamer there who's like a programmer of the story. So we need to, by focusing on, it says in the book of Deuteronomy, Zechor Yemot Olam, remember the days of old. You know, ask about it. Ask your elders and they'll tell you. You know, that we have an idea that it's not one of the 613 commandments, but, you know, Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, who was a scholar from Columbia University years ago, he's no longer with us, but he came out with a book in the 70s based on a series of talks he gave on the unique Jewish relationship with history. And that's what Passover is really about, because it's the birth of the Jewish nation is the holiday of Passover. The birth of the world might be commemorated by Rosh Hashanah, but the birth of us as a people, as a nation, is Passover. And that's when we want to get clear about what the plot of the story is about. And Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi says in his book, Zachor, he says that Herodotus, who was a Greek who wrote about 2,500 years ago, says Herodotus is the father of history. We assume that people always recorded history. It's not true. For thousands of years, first of all, most people were illiterate. People didn't record history. The Greeks started the process of recording history, and now it's become quite commonplace. He said the Greeks, Herodotus might be the father of history, but the father of meaning and history of the Jews. That it's precisely by understanding that we're not randomly stumbling through a series of events that have no beginning and no end and no point, that we're in a control process leading to a destination, and that there are rules to this game, and there are patterns that are established that we have to focus on. That because we have, you know, we in Passover, we are focusing on, you think about it, Passover has become a very kind of universal holiday. All the presidents for years have had seders in the White House.
Right.
Because the theme, if you ask what Passover is about, it's about freedom. And it's, this is not something new. You know, if you look at the, you know, like slaves in America, black slaves in America, you know, they're the songs about, you know, about getting out of slavery are all related to the Bible. Like Swing Low, I looked over Jordan, what did I see? Coming for to carry, a band of angels coming for to carry me home. You know, all of that, that whole image has become, the biblical narrative of the Exodus story has become sort of the classic image of redemption in human history. Even in Thanksgiving, you know, in America, which was celebrated early, starting the 17th century, early 7th, you know, the whole notion of the early settlers in the United States viewed themselves as reenacting the Exodus narrative, escaping from the persecution of not ancient Egypt, but the oppression of rulers who were crushing their religious freedom in Europe, crossing the Atlantic, which was the Yam Suf, the Reed Sea, coming to the Promised Land, which was the United States. Plymouth Rock is literally making a new covenant with God. So it's kind of become a hyper focus on this idea of freedom. But we understand that when we're sitting at our Passover table, especially at this specific year, that we need to focus on, we're thanking God for taking us out, you know, Dayenu, 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 if he had done this, if he had done that, if he'd brought us to here. But the reality is, who put us in there in the first place?
Right. Right.
I say Judaism is not like, it's not like, you know, Christianity is an idea of a dualistic idea that, you know, good comes from God and bad comes from the devil. So we Jews recognize that the good and the bad, ultimately, it's all good, even if we don't see it in this world with a narrow view. And it all comes from God, which is why when bad things happen, like my father who passed away 4.5 months ago, the first thing I heard my sister told me, he was no longer with us, was Baruch Dayan Emet. Blessed is the truthful judge. Now, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That kind of thing. So that this is, God puts us in as a family to take us out as a nation, not to like just let us go free and run around and do whatever we like. Here's an airplane ticket and a credit card. But he brings us to a place called Mount Sinai, which is where we basically sign a contractual agreement with the creator of the universe, which is an agreement that was kind of an oral agreement made with our great grandfather Abraham that we commit to collectively as a people at Mount Sinai, which is also, by the way, Ellie, very unique because we're the only nation that becomes a nation outside our national homeland. You know, other nations become a nation. You migrate into a piece of real estate. Develop a common culture and shared historical experience, and then eventually you raise a flag and you salute it. And you're a nation.
Right.
We become a nation in a mountain in the middle of Norway. We don't even know where the mountain is. Some insignificant little hill, where we commit, we pledge allegiance not to a piece of real estate or a flag, but to a certain moral, ethical, spiritual mission, which has been, you know, the raison d'etre, the reason for being of the Jewish people in our history. And that is important when,
and also uniquely, we pledge a relationship. Like we pledge to have a relationship with this God that, unique to most of the ancient gods of history, is not bound by land. Meaning most of the ancient gods, like you moved around from country to country and then you worship whatever God was in that country or that town or that city. And so here we are, the Jews being taken out of Egypt and into the desert. And we're pledging to have a relationship with this God that is a relationship with God, not with the land necessarily in the same way. Like that God is with us in Toronto and is also with us in Israel. And how do we understand that? Well, that's because it's a relationship with the God, not just with the place where that relationship happened, which I think is so interesting in terms of, even thinking about Passover, that literally people all over the world are having this experience of Passover, doesn't matter where they are, and having and doing that as part of their relationship with God that was started, you know, with the Exodus from Egypt and then solidified at Sinai. So it's such an interesting, you know, we're very much not a religion, we're a relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A relationship, and it's a contractual relationship that has rules to it, and has a kind of a game book to it. There's a story, there's a plan, there's something we're supposed to be going. It's and especially, which is why it's so important, you know, when you're under a it's very hard to think clearly when there's a lot of pressure on you, which is why Passover is going to be a great time for wherever we are as Jews, whether in diaspora in Israel, to really re-engage with the story that all of us have done many, many times over, and refocus on that we are still in that story. This is not just something that happened in the past. It says in every generation, we have to look at ourselves as if we were taken out of Egypt, not because we were physically taken out of Egypt, but because we are, just as the mission we were given that generation that was taken out of Egypt, that mission is still on our heads today. The rules of the game are the same. The plot is the same. The destination, which is not just a physical destination, land of Israel, but it's a moral, spiritual destination, which is the end game of all of human history, the idea of redemption, just as, you know, Passover is the immediate redemption of Jewish people from slavery. The Mount Sinai story is kind of symbolic of the ultimate redemption of not just the Jewish people, but of all of humanity. And that's really, 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 really important. It's like in the middle of a battle and you're stuck in the foxhole and all you can see is 3 feet around you in the foxhole, but there's a big battle going on. You know, you're a part of it. You might not see your role in it, but you are part of it. But it's kind of good to like go up in the observation balloon and look down on the battlefield and see how things are shaping up. So I really think this year in Passover, not only because of the threats, but also, as you mentioned correctly, I remember I've been around a long time, and I was very involved in the Soviet Jewry movement back in the days when the Soviet Union was persecuting Jews, not allowing them to leave.
Right.
And the motto of that movement was, let my people go. So, and now we have hostages who are sitting in Gaza now. God knows how many of them are left alive. We don't even know. Hamas announced they can only find 20 of them. That's a horrifying thought.
It's a horrifying thought
that there's more than 100 people who are unaccounted for. But I think we'll be able to understand the whole concept of let my people go and freedom on a very different level this year, because, you know, the whole idea of a Passover Seder, you invite people in at the beginning. And the idea is that until we are all free, none of us are really free. That is the idea of collective responsibility of the Jewish people, that we are all in the story. And that's the other interesting thing that has really happened since October 7th, which was the last big holiday, which was the Sukkot holiday, is that whether we're in Israel facing direct threats from Hamas, or whether you're in Toronto or God knows New York or San Francisco, look what happened like a couple of days ago on the 15th, with everyone blocking bridges and, you know, screaming in America, they're screaming death to America and death to Israel. But, you know, the world is reminding us that we are all part of this nation, regardless of where we're located geographically. And we're all in the same story together. And I think it's really going to be an unusually intense and meaningful Passover experience for all of us.
Yeah, beautiful. So I think this is, you know, this is basically where we can take our Seder and our thoughts and all of this uncertainty that we're going into the holiday with this year. You know, we did say we were going to wrap up with our last episode, but it looks like in light of what's happening, in light of all of these developments, you know, we'll do our best to keep sort of giving updates whenever we can. I think, as you said, this is a really incredibly, you know, like we were talking about last week, very interesting times that just continue to get more and more interesting as we go along. So maybe what we'll do is we'll sort of watch what's happening over Passover, and maybe we'll do one or two more episodes after to just sort of get a sense of where things are. We could talk about that in the coming days.
Yeah, exactly. I think you froze on me there. But just like a little bit, just a little bit. You froze. But you know, interesting, Ellie, also just another little food for thought we should think about, because we just had Purim and now we're at Passover back to back. These holidays more or less come. There's a big difference. In Passover, we see God's open intervention in history. You know, it's the most in any, there's no place in the entire Jewish history of the Bible where God more openly, he totally flips the laws of nature over something he does not like to do. And you know, basically just demonstrate that I'm God and I run the world. Open miracles and sea splitting and plagues hitting. And you get to the Purim narrative, which takes place much later in Jewish history between the first and second temple period. But there, God is completely hiding behind the scenes in seemingly coincidental events. But when they're open, everyone looks back. When the whole story is open and the salvation, we seem that they were doomed. We were up against the wall and the tide had turned against us. And then everything is flipped over very quickly. And we end up at the bottom to being at the very top. Everyone realizes that although God's name isn't, you know, God, there's no open miracles. And it's one of the two books in the Bible, along with the Song of Songs, where God's name isn't even mentioned in the story. Everyone realized that his hand was behind the scenes. And that is so important also to see in terms of, you know, not getting down or depressed. You know, we talk about the statistical probability of over 300 missiles and drones and ballistic missiles being launched at a country. And basically 99% of them intercepted. That's pretty amazing. You could explain it, you know, as we say, derech hateva, through natural explanation of technology and missile interception and Iron Dome and David Sling. But the reality is that's how God works in the world. That is so, so important to when we are looking at the situation around us, to recognize, right, like we see my t-shirt in back of me, that you know, God runs the world, and the nations that come against us, we've outlasted all of them. And to also recognize that there's miracles taking place all the time. We're not alone in this struggle. And it will turn out all right. It doesn't mean we can be complacent. It's very clear. I don't want to go into this now because it's too much of a conversation. We've sort of talked about it before, but you know, the sources, the mystical sources, especially from 500 years ago, all talk about that the final struggle between Israel is not going to be with our ancient nemesis, or however they say the word, but it's going to be with the Ishmaelite exile. That the Islamic Arab world threats against Israel will be the final threats, and it's scary because we're in the middle of it. But then that's again another proof that just as it was predicted going back over 500 years ago by some of the great mystical thinkers, primarily in Sfat, that's really where we're in now. I mean, I'm not going to predict when the Messiah is coming. If I knew that, I'd be a prophet. If I was a prophet, I'd be working in Wall Street. I wouldn't be speaking to you now. But it's clear that big wheels are turning. Whether we're going to get another a break in the middle here and things are quieting down, or whether we're going to move to the end, the conclusion of this amazing story, don't know. But we got to keep that. We always got to keep the big picture in mind. We always have to stand back and recognize like where we fit in, and we're not alone. Not just we have friends in the world, but we have the big guy upstairs who's definitely taking care of us. And we just have to do, as a people, we have to focus on our unity. And being educated, proactive, proud Jews, and being good role models for the world, and you know, the rest will be taken care of for us. So that's really what we need to do. And hopefully we will see the real redemption, the final redemption, for not just us, but for all of humanity soon and in our
Amen.
days. And this should be the
Amen.
last Passover we ever have without a temple in Jerusalem.
Amen. Amen. Awesome. Okay. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Thank you so much, Rabbi Ken Spiro from Jerusalem. I think that was a really needed check-in with what's happening. Again, please share, like, subscribe, send us questions. If you have ideas that you'd like us to talk about, please let us know. And thank you so much, everyone, for joining. Have a Chag Kasher v'Sameach, Pesach, and God willing, it won't be as interesting as it has been just for a few days or so. That would be great.
Amen. Thanks, Ellie.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.